Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, component costs of capital. Starting out this with a few starters. The stock market is having a growly day here. It's nothing spectacular. Got to show you something though here in a minute once I go through the numbers on the screen. As you can see, the Dow is down not too much, just about 0.15%. And then the S&P is down more, about a third of a percent. And the NASDAQ is down just a little bit more than that. So it's a sour day all over. Overall, it's just a sour day. So there's that part. And of course, crude oil is showing some life again as it wants to. It's going to keep moving up. It'll have some down days, but overall, it's going to keep moving up. Here's something interesting, is that the metals have shown some pretty good life here. Look at this. You got gold up about 1% and silver up more than 1.5% today. So there's money coming out of the equities. Investors are selling the equities, and that's why the price of them is going down. And then they're using some of that money to buy up some metals. And then the bonds, the yield has dropped by about 4.5 basis points, which means the price is up. So there's money flowing into bonds, money flowing out of equities, stocks, and into bonds and metals. That's a flight to quality. Investors are sort of getting over into the safer regions of investments. Now, London was up nicely. It's finishing up right now. And it's on a little bit of a bear run here at the end of its day. Nikkei was down, just fluttering down through its trading day. But near the end, it had a bull rally. So you can see that over in Japan, there was something that was giving them good news. Now, coming over here again, just a quickly look at the S&P 500 volume so far today. Oh, boy, it's just not, there's just not a lot of money. So no matter whether it's going up or down, you're seeing a lot of money staying on the sidelines, money and capital. I mean, we have not even made it to a billion shares yet, and the typical day would have 4 billion, and we're more than halfway through the day now, I think. So, yeah, this is, whatever it is, a bull or a bear day. This is at the margins. The big, heavy money is waiting to see what happens next. And then, of course, to have a look here, the yield curve, just to brighten your day. Here you go. You've got 9 basis points down today. It's really showing a lot of signs, and you've been seeing this for some time. Here's the hilarious part. Let me type in news. And let's say yield curve. Look at Google News. It seems that just in the last day or two, suddenly all of these business services have noticed that there's an inverted yield curve. U.S. Yield curve, this was 20 hours ago. U.S. yield curve, Treasury yield curve inverts in recession sign. Oh my God, 23 hours ago. Analysis, U.S. Treasury yield curve flashes red to investors. Hot breaking news. How long have you seen the yield curve that invert? I gave it on the 15th of March, the inversion happened. And suddenly, slow to catch up, has figured out there's a yield curve inversion. Well, spank me hard and call me George. Yes, it already happened, and it's already told us. And now you're getting all of these analysts talking about flashes recession warning. yield curve inverts and all this kind of stuff. Good grief, people. It did it last more than almost 2 weeks ago, for God's sake. And yet, so this gives you an idea of what it means to actually learn business. You're in the business world. You're getting a fine business education from a ranked school. This gives you a warning about how reliable the internet can be, even when you're looking at reputable news services. They can be behind the yield curve, as it were, by a long shot when things are heating up. So it's good for you to know how to look at the data yourselves so that you can tell for yourself when things are happening instead of relying on these Johnny-come-latelys in the markets to do that for you. But yeah, that's a nasty inversion right there. It is, I mean, you've got 54, 49. You got almost, see that double one, I think someone actually asked me about that. There is a double inversion, 54 to 49, then it pops to 250, and then it drops, wow, way down. And then it arcs right there. It really does an arch there at the 20-year. So we've got some good signs that there's going to be a recession coming up. How bad? Like I said, I am not thinking that it's going to be more than moderate, but there you are. Anyhow, let me take you on a little bit of a story here. This is about the cost of capital. Now, I went through the basic ones, and let me write those down again for you. After a while, you get kind of used to this thing, these formulas, and plugging the numbers in. And Friday, I'll give you a couple of nice examples of it to help you out with this. But for debt, there is a cost of debt, and then there is the after-tax cost of debt, which is the cost of debt, times 1 minus the marginal tax rate. Now, for the cost of debt, if you really were desperate, just get the coupon off their highest, off their riskiest debt instrument. That's what they're going to pay, at least that. The yield to maturity, that's the least that they would pay for the next round of debt if they have to borrow more. So for that, you would be best to use the YTM, the yield to maturity, for that. In other words, the market's assessment of what the risk of the debt of the corporation is. Not what. See, the coupon is going to tell you what the risk was at the time this bond was issued. The yield to maturity tells you what investors say it should be right now. So, and I mean, those are, you just grab it off services. I showed you how to get yields to maturity. But, I mean, in real practice, you would just pull it off one of those quotation services to get that. There's an interesting thing, a sidelight, which the book actually brings up, and it's one of those oddball, how can this possibly be? But it is. If you look at the debt, the cost of debt for some of the biggest companies on earth, companies like Walmart, Coca-Cola, and you look at their calculate their after-tax cost of debt, it can actually be below the rate on a treasury. What is Coca-Cola's? The book is actually kind of out of date, and I'm really fussing at them right now to get a newer edition. But at the time of publication of your textbook, Coca-Cola's after-tax cost of debt was like 1.56%. Now, how could that? That's just amazing. The at that time, the risk-free rate, our proxy for it, a treasury bill's yield, was about 2% or something like that. And so for these very large corporations, their after-tax cost of debt is insanely low. It's almost like free money to a certain extent for those big, huge corporations. Now you get to the smaller ones and it gets to be at least a little bit saner numbers, 3%, 5%, something like that, the after-tax cost of debt. For a company like mine, as long as I don't borrow too much, the after-tax cost of debt would be 8.99%. percent times 1 minus 0.15. So, I mean, for a small company, it was still pretty cheap, steep, although it was cheaper than it has been historically. But anyway, that's the after-tax cost of debt. Now, the for equity, and this is sort of like a summary you can put in your notes, for preferred, and I'm not going to go back through how we get these, I'm just going to write them down for you so you've got them. The cost of preferred stock would be the dividend that the stock, that preferred stock pays. It says that in the stock certificate. Preferred stock, 1.5% preferred, par value $50. So it's 1.5% times $50 is your dividend every year forever, divided by the current price of the preferred stock. Just look up the price and you got it. So if I ask this on a quiz, don't kill yourself. It's just really fast to get it. Let me do this one. Now, common stock. Common stock is the one that is kind of nasty. There are three different ways that we can get it, depending upon what data is best for us to grab. Now, one way to get it is just use the capital asset pricing model. The cost of the stock, and this is common, is going to be the risk-free rate plus the beta of the stock times expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. I mean, if you see me give you the beta, you know right away it's one. Just plug the numbers in. I'll give you all the numbers. Just plug in to get the... Now, the second way is for companies that are mature that have a constant growth rate of their dividend. You can pull it off by saying the cost of the common is going to be the dividend in the next period over the price of the current price of the stock, common stock, plus the growth rate. Now that dividend period one is the dividend now times one plus G. If I say the dividend next period will be, you've already got the D1. If I say they just paid a dividend, you have to grow it one period to get this. The benefit of that formula is, yeah, for old companies, this is the way you would do it. Companies that have a nice stable dividend that's growing at a predictable rate and all that. But it also has the benefit that it allows us an insight into how that common stock, how the cost of common equity of your shareholders that are out there already, how that is affected by the price and how it's affected by the growth rate. So a question I could give you on a quiz or an exam is simply this. As the stock price increases, the cost of existing equity goes up, stays the same, down, cannot be determined. Well, it's obvious that if the price of the stock goes up, this fraction goes down, so the whole piece goes down. So in other words, as the stock price goes up, the cost of a common equity goes down. Nothing hard there. And then there's this last one. It's sort of our, if we don't have any better way to do it, the cost of common stock, we can always kind of fall back on this, okay, it's the bond yield, the YTM, plus an equity risk premium. How much equity for typical companies like this one, how much its cost of capital, their cost of capital, is above their cost of debt? There's one last thing in here, a minor side note, but just to start this off, and I've already said this, and I'll show you, and I'm going to give you a very grotesque example of it from my own world work as a consultant many years ago. But when a company has to issue a security, it's probably going to go through some kind of an investment banking house. These, I need to sell $50 million worth of stock. and an investment banking syndicate would say, okay, we'll buy it from you and then we'll sell it. And we're going to charge you some scratch. That's a flotation cost, we call it. The same is true with any, well, we would like to issue some debt. Well, an investment banking house says, okay, we shall buy that bond issue series from you, that bond issue from you. In other words, we'll lend you the money, then we'll sell those bonds to investors. And the same would be true of preferred stock. We'd like to issue preferred stock, and an investment banking house would say, okay, we'll buy it from you, here's your money, and then we'll sell it to our investors, our clients. Here's the thing, though, and this is something that was a little bit surprising because, as I said, I teach an MBA version of this course, and the truth of the matter is it's really just this course, but we call it an MBA-level course. And so how do we know it's a more important course? Because it's 440 instead of 240. But it's really a lot of it's the same material as this. But an odd thing in that textbook that I use for that course is that they say there's a flotation cost, whether it's debt, preferred, or common stock. In other words, an investment banking house is going to charge money for doing any of these underwritings, firm commitment underwritings. Actually, in the real world, that's not quite true. With bonds and preferred, there is actually not much of a flotation cost at all. Because it's so easy to unload. Once an investment banking house has lent a big, huge corporation money, it's just like almost a phone call to get rid of that to some investor that wants those bonds. So there's really hardly any cost involved at all. In real practice, we don't adjust that formula right there at all for flotation costs on debt. Now, where it really caught me was when that textbook said, well, there's a big flotation cost on preferred. I know for a fact from my consulting that there isn't. Preferred is so easy to place. Some of you have probably heard of it, an REIT, a real estate investment trust. They're sort of like these ginormous souffles. They go out and they see a commercial property. Okay, here's a shopping mall. You know, it could be an indoor mall, it could be a strip mall, something like that. Okay, we'd like to buy that. So what they do is they go out and they raise the money by selling stock to investors. And then they use that money to buy the shopping mall or whatever it is, or an apartment complex. And this is something that went back to legislation in 1960. As long as the REIT disgorges 95% of its profits every year to its investors, it isn't taxed. It's taxed. It's a tax-free entity. So, it's like basically they go out, they find properties, they rehab them, flip them, and then they issue a dividend to their shareholders, and then they go on to the next one, growing and growing as they do this. Well, I did consulting for an REIT back in 1996, 97. Right when I was doing it, they were looking at a shopping mall in... I think it was in Kansas City. And they negotiated a price for it of $900,000. It was in bad shape. They were going to rehab it, and then they'd flip it, obviously. But they worked directly with an investment banking /bank in Japan. And they just called them on the phone and said, we'd like to buy a $900,000 property. Would you buy the preferred stock so that we can do that? Literally, even back then, it was 24 hours and the $900,000 was in the account of the REIT to do it. There was no flotation cost. We want to issue $900,000 worth of stock. They sent them $900,000 to get it. There wasn't any, we'll keep some for our own books or anything like that. None. So preferred stock really doesn't have a flotation cost. The only one where you have to make an adjustment for new equity, R/N, would be that one for common stock. it would be a slight adjustment, and we use this formula to do it. How do you adjust for the flotation cost? Let me give you a story. Back in the time when I was doing consulting, and I can tell more about what I did now because, honestly, the statute of limitations is gone. But I had gotten myself involved with a couple of young men who had an enormous amount of money behind them. And their families had contacted me through an intermediary. Can you start traveling with them to keep them in line and make sure they don't do stupid things? Be their sort of the older guy who's going to guide them when they're doing the investments of our family's money. There were two families involved in this. And I didn't ask about the money, where it was coming from. Yeah. So anyway, we had done a couple of gigs. Companies wanted to raise some money. And so we did private placements of their stock, common stock private placements. In other words, the family would buy a block of stock. That money would go to the company, and the company would use it to get their operations moving at a higher level. Everything, but let me give you an example of flotation costs. The two young men, I called them the Momo boys. They called me and they said, "We need to meet down at the airport in Atlanta. We've got a guy there who's got an interesting idea. We want you to be there so he can pitch it to you. We can see how it works." Well, we got there late in the afternoon. By the time we had figured out that he was in a giant trailer in a back lot of the airport, and back there were all these other big trailers for little, carrier operations and other kinds of things involved in airplanes. His was there. We figured out which one it was, and we went in. And this guy, he was old. He had kind of a long silver beard, piercing blue eyes, and he had a big cigar in his mouth. "Come in, come in." And all around were these stacks of paper, some of them bound, some of them loose. These were all the applications for FAA approval for his plan. What he had in mind was he needed the money because there was an airline. It was called Lufthansa. They had gone to Taft City, and they had a bunch of planes, an MD series jets. He wanted to lease those and then use those to provide courier service for the United States Postal Service, DHL, and others. "I'll fly your packages." It was actually kind of a radical idea, outsourcing the flying of the packages for a big courier, for the big carriers. Okay, well, this sounds interesting. FAA approvals were right there in all these documents, and he was a very odd fellow. For some reason, he looked at me and he said, "You've got the vision." And I thought, "Oh, Jesus." But anyway, so we said, "Okay, how much do you need?" $5 million. He had the work out of it all there. And so we said, "Okay, we can do it. I think we'll talk about it with our sources of the rain and see if we can make the rain for you." And we're good now. So we're going to put together $7 million to do the deal. And he just looked, he put a cigarette, he said, $5 million. Yeah, $5 million. $7 million. We keep $2 million. That's our float. Oh, he just hit the roof. He just went, embers were coming off his cigar, cussing and swearing at us. And so we just got up and we thanked him very professionally. We were all dressed nice. We had a very nice car we'd rented for this. We made sure we parked it a good ways away, and then we started walking toward the car. And one of the two boys was very nice. He was a sweet kid. He had a baby face, and he walked behind us, and he lagged. And finally, sure enough, "Dan, come here, please, come on." We heard him calling. So Dan said, "Guys, please, can you wait? He wants to talk." So we went to the car, and we just stood there looking at our watches. We had these big mobile phones of the time, and he looking irritated. And he went back, and he finally came back to us, and he said, "Okay, he's on the hook. 6.5. And we yelled and cussed, very loudly so we could hear it. And then finally we said, yeah, just go over and tell him, that's fine. So we went over, we had the deal. It was all a game, of course, obviously. He knew there was no other way he was going to get that money. And so that's how the story worked. Flotation cost, $1.5 million on his books that was going to do nothing for the company. That's what flotation costs do. They take down the amount of money that is going to actually be used by the company, even though the company is on the hook for $50 a share. If the brokers take, investment bankers take $5 out of every share, then the company has $45 to work with, even though it is responsible for $50 million. That's how these deals work. That's what flotation cost does. It bleeds down the amount of actual capital that the company will get. Flotation cost bleeds down the amount of actual capital that the company, equity capital that the company will get. This story has an interesting ending. And it's actually, you would see the story in a movie called Made in America. About 2 weeks later, we had everything ready to go. We were going to get together with him, have dinner, do the deal, sign the documents, give him the check. And he called up and he said, can't do it. The FAA had shut down his plan. What the hell, man? We did all this. Why did you said everything? Yeah, it was until they found out who I was. Well, who are you? Well, it's not who I am. It's what I got. I got in some trouble. What kind of trouble? It was years ago. I was caught landing a DC-3 in Louisiana in a field, and I had a DC-3 full of marijuana. Okay, how? Well, you see, it was part of a whole deal where we would get marijuana and buy it from the people in Central America. We would fly it and sell it to drug dealers in the United States, and then that money would go over to Iran, and they would buy weapons, the CIA would, to give to the rebels in Central America who were trying to overthrow a communist dictatorship down there in Nicaragua. That was what was called the Iran-Contra scandal. He was one of the mules who was flying the planes. If you watch the movie Made in America with Tom Cruise, they show those pilots what they were doing. And of course, he told the DEA, no, no, I'm working for the CIA. And of course, they had nothing to do with it. They weren't interested at all. Sure you did. And of course, you know, CIA is going to say, no, what? It blew open. This was in 1980 that he was caught. The whole thing blew open in 1982-83 at the show. And so if you see those planes in the movie flying all that marijuana, that was, one of them was probably a depiction of this stupid idiot in that trailer in the middle of nowhere. He served 6 years, two off for good behavior, but, so that's the end of the story. No $1.5 million, darn it. Anyway, here's how we do it. If it's new equity, we adjust the formula by taking the flotation cost off as a percent. Now, you can also take it off as a dollar amount if you want. But if I say, well, the float is going to be 5%, then you would take the stock price, $50, let's say, times 1 minus 0.05. So in other words, the return on the cost of new equity is going to be more than the cost of existing equity. So selling new stock is even worse than the cost of the shareholders you have now, as far as the cost of, component cost of capital goes. This is old stuff. How big is that float? The textbooks now talk about 6%, 1 minus 0.06. Back in the day, there were no stops on it at all. It could be 20, 25%, which is what I saw back in my time. But now it's supposedly, about 5%, 6% of the stock price will be kept by the investment bankers. They'll call it things like, well, that's the cost of preparing it. That's the transactions fees. That's the accounting and the lawyers. We charge this because we have them. Yes. Yeah, because it deferred. Wait, for common stock, it's always a D1. Preferred, the dividend is the same forever. It's a flat dividend forever. It's like they say 1.5% of the par value. Remember the stock price? The price of preferred stock is going to be the dividend over R. So you turn that around, R is the dividend over the price of the preferred. And that's because the dividend is constant. It's the same forever on preferred. So anyway, I give you a flotation cost. If I give it to you as a percent, you do 1 minus F. If I give it to you as a dollar amount, you just take the price minus that float. One way or the other, though, it causes the price of the stock to be more. JVN, common, will pay a dividend of $2.50 in 1 year. Now notice here that I'm telling you the D1. I'm not telling you the D0 and then you have to grow it one period. I'm telling you the D1. If the growth rate of dividends is expected to be 4% per year, and the current price right now of JVN common is $25 per share. What is their cost? What is the company's cost of existing common stock? I'm trying to write bigger. I hope you can read that in the back. Let me read that again. JVN Common will pay a dividend of $2.50 in 1 year. So I've given you D1. If I'd said it just paid a dividend, then you would have to grow that dividend 1 year, 1 plus G, but I gave you the D1. If the growth rate of dividends is expected to be 4% per year and the price right now of JVN Common is $25 per share, what is the company's cost of existing common stock? Well, that would be... we'll use this one because it's a stable dividend growing at a nice clean rate. The cost of existing common would be D1, $2.50, divided by the current price, $25, plus the growth rate of the dividends, 0.04. D1 over the current price plus G. Crank it down. Okay, and turn on the stupid calculator. Let's try this. Okay, we'll do $2.50 divided by $25 plus 0.04, and you get 14%. That's all there is to it. Sometimes I make it look awfully easy, but when you're on a quiz or an exam, everything kind of fogs up real fast. If you do it real quickly and don't think about it, it's a lot easier. Now, suppose we have gotten to the point where we have to turn to new equity. In that case, let's say if the company can sell new issue common with a, let's say, a 5% float, what is the cost of new equity? I tell you, questions like this and the ones I did with the horizon value, those are going to be your biggest challenges as far as math goes on your final exam and on a quiz. It doesn't get much worse than this kind of stuff, but this is actually pretty straightforward. All you do is put in the formula. We're going to do the same formula, $2.50, divided by, except this time we have $25 times 1 minus the float, 5%, plus the growth rate. See, it's the same formula, but you just have to make that adjustment there in the denominator because the company is not going to get $25. It's going to get $25 minus the 5% float. So if you crank that one out, and I'm not even going to try to do that one in my head, 2.5, $2.50, divided by, now I'm going to open parentheses here to do this. I don't probably have to for most of it. $2.50 divided by $25 times 1 minus 0.05. Close the parenthesis. And then that's right, I put in an extra one I didn't need to there. Try that one more time. I'm just testing you. You're right. I just wanted to see if you would see that I made that mistake. 14.53%. There you go. So that's just a quick example. The cost of new equity is going to be more expensive than the cost of existing equity. You issue new equity, you're going to pay for it because someone's going to have to do it for you. Like I said, these days there are limits on what that float could be overseeing organizations. Truth be told, that hidden costs are in there, so it isn't really that much less now than it was back in the day. But, you know, 5%, 6% is pretty typical, and I'd do something like that on a quiz or an exam of 5 or 6%. Just watch it when you're doing the parentheses in the denominator there. One last issue on this. You see that common stock, that R sub S, in a really loose, not really right kind of way, you can say that that is the cost of your retained earnings, the company's cost of retained earnings, or the cost of its free cash flow at the very bottom line. It's the cost of what the company has made internally that it can then use for other projects. So the thing would be that, giving this some context for you. Madam, I am the CFO and you are the president, the CEO of the corporation. Not that I appreciate that they looked past me to hire you. I still think that was a wrong decision, but it happened. So there you are, the treasurer of the company, and you've got this box of $10 million. And so I say, okay, I got three projects that we found that they are good to go, and one of them is going to cost $4 million, the other is going to cost $8 million, and the other one's going to cost $5 million. So I come to you, and there you are sitting on the, with that box. What do you want? $4 million? Okay. You open up. This is the money that the company has earned, and you give me $4 million. Okay. Now, you mix that with some debt, probably, but let's just say it's equity only. So you give me the $4 million. And so I come back a little later, and I say, evil master, I need $5 million more. And you pull out, and you give me some money. And finally, I come back. I need, like, you know, some more. How much more? I worked this out. I think we can get it down to $3 million. $3 million? Are you out of your mind? And so you hit me over the head with the box. But then the $1 million comes out, and I gather it up, and I'm backing out of the room. You said, wait a minute, fat boy. You said you need $3 million. All I had was $1 million. So what are we going to do for the other $2 million? That's when we go and we sell News Common stock. The break point there was the $10 million. We calculate the break point. It actually has to do with the weighted average cost of capital. And I'll go through this in another example on Friday. But here's the break point formula. It's not hard. The break point is available internally generated equity, retained earnings. We can just say retained earnings for now. How much you have in that treasury box divided by the percent of equity in your capital structure. Show you an example. Let's say you have retained earnings of, let's say, $10 million. Now, equity projects, when you use equity, let's say that the percent of equity in capital in your capital structure is 75%. In other words, your company is 75% equity and 25% debt. So in other words, you fund 75% of your company with equity and 25% with debt. So all you do to find out when you would have to go and sell New Common stock, you would say, in this case, I have $10 million to use that we've made through our operations, divided by 0.75. So in other words, the result would be 10 million divided by 0.75. 13,333,333. So in other words, practically speaking, we can fund projects up to what would require $13 million of equity capital. The rest we would fund through the debt that we would borrow. Only after we had crossed that threshold. And if you look at this, this is how much equity we would throw into the project. We'd mix that with debt. Once we'd hit the limit on spending this much equity, we would then have to sell common stock. This looks like some abstract exercise. It's quite real. All companies do this. This is how we do the capital budgeting, is we figure out how far we can go with projects before we have to call the investment bankers and say, hey, we're going to have to sell stock. Okay, that's enough for today. That's all I have for you. I thank you.